Thank you, choir. It's lovely to hear you, and it's wonderful to be here with all of you. I have such fond memories of this congregation and the time that I spent with you. I've been serving a congregation in Sacramento for 5.5 years now, and I'm fortunate enough to have earned enough time for a sabbatical. So I'm on a sabbatical for January through March. One of the things that I've been doing on sabbatical is taking some classes in things that are not really about church, but of course they are, because, you know, that's who I am. But I'm taking a class on medieval cathedrals, really enjoying it, and learning a lot about the cathedrals and how the idea of having a relic at the cathedral was an important part of the Catholic theology. A relic, of course, would be the body of a saint, or even possibly a piece of a saint, a finger bone of a saint, or a relic of Christianity, like a piece of the crown of thorns that they believed is actual original, or a piece of a shirt that Mary wore at some time. This helps bring them right back down to the past and connect them deeply and solidly with who they are by having a tangible piece of the history of their faith. Some of you who were raised Catholic, I see some nods out there, understand the importance of relics. Unitarian Universalism, on the other hand, I've heard it said, is not a rock to cling to, but a river to swim in. And even though we are this river to swim in, ever changing, ever growing, ever shifting, I think it's really important for us to understand our past, where we've come from, the challenges we face, the choices that we've made, to really appreciate who we are. We are a liberal religion. A river is flowing and changing. We're a liberal religion that believes that revelation is not sealed, that we're learning and growing, and the traditions of our faith can shift as time goes on. Those of you who know a little bit about Unitarian and Universalist history will know that the Unitarians were originally the Puritans, who became the Congregationalists back in New England, and then the Unitarians emerged from the Congregationalists, whereas the Universalists came out of a theology that was in response to the Calvinist idea of the depravity of humans. Universalists were saying that God is a loving God and that all are saved. So these are sort of the original origins of who we are as Unitarian Universalists. So I like to think of that as our roots. And this river, this liberal flowing, changing, as being the wings of who we are, responding to the winds and responding to the changes in our world. But today I'm going to focus a little bit on our roots. I've picked 5 defining moments in Unitarian Universalist history. I'm sure you would probably have 5 different moments. There are so many. But these are the ones I've chosen. I thought it was rather audacious at first, but I've sort of gotten used to it, that I have my 5 moments. They're loosely chronological. They're not necessarily in order of importance. So I'm going to share 3 of them with you, and then we'll have the offering, and then I'll share the final 2 with you. So here we go. The first defining moment is when William Ellery Channing spoke out against slavery. Some of you may be familiar with Channing. He was really the most prominent Unitarian minister in the early 19th century. And he wrote a sermon in 1819 called Unitarian Christianity, where he defined Unitarianism in the United States and began our separation from the Congregationalists. He talked about we should use reason to decide our faith, that humans were not depraved, that the Bible is a tool for us, but not necessarily the Word of God. Radical, radical ideas in the early 19th century. But that's not why I've chosen him for my first defining moment. When Channing was starting out in his life, he spent some time as a tutor to a family in Virginia, and he was really sickened by seeing slavery firsthand. But after he'd gone to seminary and became a minister at one of the most important churches in Boston, he never said anything to his congregation about it for 20 years. He was against slavery, But he felt like the abolitionists were just trying to change things too quickly. They were pushing a little too hard. He was very uncomfortable with that. And also his congregation was filled with businessmen who were deeply tied to the slave trade through their textile factories. So finally, some of his colleagues convinced him to take a stand. He wrote a book stating the case against slavery in 1835, very far along in his career. And it created an uneasy truce with his congregation, sort of like, you could write that book, but don't bring it up on Sunday morning. This all came to a head in 1840 when a friend of Channing's, Charles Follett, a well-known abolitionist, died. And Channing finally preached that sermon, a powerful sermon, a powerful anti-slavery sermon in his congregation. And he asked the congregation if they would be willing to hold the memorial for Follett at the church. Follett was not a Unitarian. And the congregation said no. The sermon was a little too much for them, and then asking for them to somehow endorse this abolitionist was outside of their comfort zone. And Channing quit. And that was the last congregation that he had served. So the lesson in this, the reason why this is a defining moment for me, is because I really think it speaks to each of us, this idea of holding back what we really feel like we need to say, speaking up for injustice, but the fears that hold us back, the fears of losing our authority, the fears of not being heard, the fears of being judged. It also speaks to the fact that sometimes the most radical voices make us really uncomfortable, partly because maybe we're not doing our part in speaking out, partly because we're worried it's going to disrupt things in a way that we can't put the genie back in the bottle or the worms back in the can. Channing's parishioners didn't want him to disrupt the status quo, the power and the privilege and the resources that they had. We see this now in our reaction to some of the issues around Black Lives Matter, the fear of speaking out and supporting Black Lives Matter, because, you know, maybe they're just asking for too much too soon, or there's some things in their platform that I'm not really comfortable with. We expect perfection from the radical voices, and then that makes us not want to speak out even in a more moderated way because of our discomfort. The perfect response to that is, of course, the letter from the Birmingham jail, when Martin Luther King Jr. wrote to the ministers who said, it's all going too fast, saying, you know, when will it ever change? And if the people of power and privilege don't speak up, the chances of changing our systems of injustice will never happen. My second defining moment comes a little later on in the time of the Western expansion. That's what they call it in Unitarian history. The Universalists were a little bit a part of it. But we had the American Unitarian Association, it wasn't of congregations at the time, it was of ministers. And they wanted to expand Unitarianism to the West, which in the mid-18th century, just post the Civil War, Minnesota and Illinois, that was the western edge of our country. We were sort of just barely a place at that point, but Unitarianism actually had roots on this coast in around the same time. But the real push was on that Midwest frontier. And they had good success establishing churches because the people that moved out there tended to be the people that wanted to think differently and take chances, more liberal-minded people. And as the churches developed, because the pioneer fringes were more liberal, they moved farther away from the Christian roots of the East Coast churches. In fact, the motto of the Western Association of Unitarian Churches was freedom, fellowship, and character in religion. This really freaked out the East Coast because there was no mention of Jesus, no mention of God, and there was no requirement of a belief in a particular doctrine. Because in Unitarianism at the time, there was a requirement of a belief. We're used to saying we don't have a creed as Unitarians and Universalists, But at the time, belief in Jesus was an important part of the Unitarian faith. Now, the East Coast was particularly nervous because earlier on in that century, there had been two really powerful ministers, Ralph Waldo Emerson and Theodore Parker, who had preached critical sermons about the relationship between Christianity and Unitarianism. Emerson had said, well, Jesus wasn't the only one who had the ideas that he shared. Oh my God, that was, and he was drummed out of the ministry. He quit the ministry. Parker said, you don't need Jesus to have a faith based on the ideas of Jesus. Drummed out of the ministry. This was more than that we could take, that our institutions could take in the early part of the 19th century. But as we moved west, it became more and more liberal and farther away from the Christian roots that we had. Finally, it all came to a head at a national conference. The folks that were proclaiming our Christianity said, if we pull up our roots, who will we be as a denomination? We are Christian. If we pull these roots up, what will become of us? But indeed, at that convention, they pulled up the roots by claiming, by agreeing to the non-creedal nature of our denomination. The Western churches could be a part of us, and they didn't have to proclaim their allegiance to Christianity. Of course, that opened the door to the humanist movement in the early 20th century. It opened the door to who we are now as Unitarian Universalists, where Christianity is a part of our heritage. Some of our members feel a strong and deep connection to the message of Jesus, but we're not a Christian faith any more than we're a Buddhist faith or a Hindu faith or name it in the pantheon of religions. We still have our Christian roots. And in one of the interesting ways, some of those Christian roots are in the individuals who find their way to Unitarian Universalism, who struggle with their history of Christianity. And that's part that we haven't really evolved yet. We haven't evolved to have a healthy relationship with Christianity. And I see that as part of where we need to go as a denomination. So my third defining moment takes place at this same time in history, the post-Civil War era. And it is also about the burgeoning movement towards the West. But it relates to women in ministry. And a book that was written by Cynthia Grant Tucker in 1990 called Prophetic Sisterhood. This part of our history was really lost to us, and she brought it back to our awareness to help us appreciate where we have come from. So if you look at the UUA website, and maybe you've learned in history classes or reading that the Universalists ordained the first woman in the United States of America, Olympia Brown. She was ordained in 1863. But what that history, you know, we love to cherry pick as Unitarian Universalists the histories that make us look really good because we want to promote ourselves in the world. So we love that we ordained the first woman, which we did. But what that story doesn't tell us is about the challenge that women had getting established in ministry. So in 1870, there were 5 women ministers in both Unitarian and Universalism and 600 men. But when Unitarianism and to a certain extent Universalism started moving west, there were smaller, more fragile congregations on the edges of civilization from our perspective, and the men didn't want to serve those congregations. So that's where the women went. And in bringing themselves to these places and bringing their feminine sensibilities to these places, they changed the nature of the ministry. Previously, it had been 2-hour sermons every Sunday, so be grateful that you didn't live in that era. And the ministers would spend hours every week doing research and writing these 2-hour sermons. But the women on the frontier really changed it up because frontier life was fragile and uncertain. And so they created welcoming environments, home-like environments. A lot of there were pictures of the churches. They'd have a big fireplace and almost like a parlor or family room kind of feel. They created activities that were outside of Sunday morning to build this sense of community for people. particularly liberal religious people who already felt that they were in a precarious situation. So by 1900, there were 100 women clergy in Unitarian and Universalist congregations, primarily out there on the prairie. And then, of course, because we're humans, and this is what we do as humans, the backlash came. And it came in the form of Samuel Eliot, a UU minister, or a Unitarian minister, who was head of the American Unitarian Association. And he felt that women had feminized ministry in a way that was not good. And it was time to refocus ministry as a male profession. So this is in the early 20th century. He had the power because he appointed the people who appointed the ministers. And so he made sure that none of the women would continue or have opportunities at other churches. And so by 1930, there were 30 women serving Unitarian and Universalist congregations, down from 100 just 30 years before that. Of course, now women are the majority of UU ministers. We have our first woman president of the Unitarian Universalist Association, a fabulous accomplishment, but I mean really, people, 2018, that's when we got to having a woman as the president of our association. So why is it important that we remember this history? I have to add on that there's also the experience of African-American ministers in the 20th century. We bemoan the fact that we're not diverse in our congregations. We're not diverse in our congregations because African-American ministers who asked to have placement in churches were denied that placement. We turned our backs on several 20th century men who wanted to establish, African-American men who wanted to establish churches. Now the edge, our learning edge, is around transgender and genderqueer individuals, and our seminaries are full of transgender and genderqueer people. It's important for us to understand our history so that we don't repeat it. Discrimination runs in cycles. Like I said, the backlash against women. We grow, and then we feel uncomfortable, and we retreat. But I do believe with each cycle, we carry enough of what we've learned before so that we can continue to grow and change and accept change in who we are as a denomination. So I look forward to sharing number 4 and 5 with you after the offering. So let us now fast forward to the middle of the 20th century. And my number 4 defining moment is the merger of Unitarian and Universalism in 1961. It's kind of an obvious defining moment in a way, because it's the time when the two denominations came together as one. But I want to share it from the perspective of the Universalists. At the time of the merger, there were 3 times as many Unitarian churches as there were Universalists. And the numbers of Universalists had been declining for decades before that. Universalism was founded on one compelling theology, and that was anti-Calvinism. Calvinism was this idea of humans were born depraved and only God knew whether you were saved or not, and that some of people were going to be damned to hell for eternity. And the Universalist message was God is a loving God. All are saved. This was a really radical message at the time. In the late 18th and early 19th century when Universalism was taking hold, Universalists couldn't be on juries. They were shunned in their communities because their message was seen so radical. But by the early 20th century, they'd done such a good job that most churches were not really engaged in preaching on human depravity and were more about the message of God's love. So in a way, they put themselves out of business by their success. Now, in the post-World War II period, they tried to redefine themselves around the idea of global community and universal love among humans to be more relevant, but it didn't work, and the numbers continued to decline. And so they were more interested in merging than the Unitarians were. There had been several attempts to merge, and some of the functions of the two denominations, the youth function came together for a while, and there were some meetings, but they never really took hold. But somehow, conversations in the 50s started to maybe make some sense for everyone. And Unitarianism was really doing well in the mid-20th century. The post-World War II boom served Unitarianism very well. And the new thinking of the 60s brought a lot of folks to Unitarianism. It took about 10 years to work out, but it needed the vote of a high percentage of all the Unitarian and Universalist congregations in order for it to be approved. And 5 weeks before the deadline of the vote, only 40% of the congregations had voted. So you can imagine how nervous the leadership that had been working on this for 10 years was about the outcome. But ultimately, 95% of the congregations participated, and I think it was a 90% requirement. Ultimately, 94% of the Universalists voted in favor, and 91% of the Unitarians voted in favor. Now, it was not a merger for love. There were a lot of reasons theologically why the two were fit, but it was really a merger for survival for the Universalists. And it was said at the time that Universalists feared that even if they did merge, they would cease to exist. They would be subsumed into the Unitarians. And you know, as most of us refer to our faith as Unitarian, in some way that's been happening. At the time, there was a saying that the Universalists were worried that they'd be swallowed up by the Unitarians. And the Unitarians were worried that they'd get indigestion by swallowing the Universalists. It says a lot about the power dynamic between the two denominations. So now we're 57 years after the merger. So did the Universalists sign the death warrant of their denomination by merging? Their faith lives on in our principles. It lives on in us. But the reason why I chose this as a defining moment was not really the obvious part. It was that in our history, there are moments of choices that were not necessarily easy choices, but choices that were made for survival, choices that were made for the hope of continuing the Universalist faith in some form in the world. And it's an example of compromise that is so much missing in our world right now, that everybody doesn't ever get their way all the time, that you have to give up something sometimes to come together. And so that's why it's a defining moment for me, that institutions have to morph and change over time in order to continue to exist. All right, now we're coming to my favorite defining moment. This is the adoption of the seventh principle. The seventh principle was adopted and voted on in 1984, and part of our liberal religion tradition is that our principles are in our bylaws, and our bylaws require that every 15 years that we revisit our principles and reconsider them and vote on them, whether to affirm them or to change them. So this effort that resulted in a vote in 1984 came out of a women in religion movement that really challenged us to take the masculine language out of our principles, out of our hymnal. And as part of that, the team that worked on it wanted to add a seventh principle: respect for the earth and the interdependence of its living systems. That was the proposal: respect for the earth and the interdependence of its living systems. Now, those of you who were adults in that era may remember ecology movements and recognition of our interconnectedness, you know, even more so now, but that was some of the efforts that were going on. And so this was the proposed. And if you know the seven principles, you already know the difference between the two: respect for the earth and the interdependence of its living systems. Now, Paul LaRue was a Unitarian Universalist minister, and he was reading his GA packet, General Assembly, preparing for the big vote on the new principles. Those of you who've been to General Assembly probably know, wow, everybody's, wow, it's a big vote. He had a lot of Buddhist, Native American spirituality, deep ecology influences, and he was a little troubled by the phrasing, because it sort of implied that we were outside of this interdependence. Respect for the earth and the interdependence of its living systems. It didn't intentionally place us clearly as part of that. We're respecting something that we're not necessarily a part of. And I'm quoting from him here. He said, "It became clear to me that for any statement to have any real depth, it must apply not only to our environmental vision, but also to our human relations." So they're at GA, they're ready to vote on this packet, and LaRue musters up his courage and heads to the amendment mic. Now, those of you who've been to GA know, oh no, somebody's at the amendment mic. We're gonna have to start, oh my, the clock's gonna reset. So he gets up to the amendment mic, and with trepidation, he puts out his amendment, and he says, "I would like to propose that we amend the seventh principle to say, respect for the interdependent web of which we are a part." Oh, murmuring among the assembled people, oh. There was some discussion, but ultimately it was overwhelmingly accepted, and our seventh principle was born. Now, why do I consider this a defining moment? Well, I'm a big fan of the seventh principle. But it was the first real theological change after the Unitarians and the Universalists came together. It was a theological statement that came out of both of our past denominations. It reflects this idea of liberal religions changing and growing and responding. The ideas of the seventh principle are ancient, but it was new to us to bring them in and make that part of the focus of how we live our faith in the world. This moment in our history reflects the power of the democratic process. There was a group of people who felt strongly about changing the principles. They brought their ideas to the General Assembly, and there was one person who had an idea of further change, and there was a process to allow that to happen. But I think this part, this event in history, really represents who we are as Unitarian Universalists, willing to be changed by what we've started, acknowledging our role in this idea of transforming ourselves, transforming each other, transforming our world, seeing ourselves in this greater community of the interdependent web. A defining moment for Unitarian Universalism. So when I was preparing this sermon, I was thinking, well, what will be the defining moments discussed 100 years from now? Will there be Unitarian Universalism 100 years from now? There will be if we continue to be relevant and empowering. There will be if the new generation coming next embraces who we are, embraces and takes us to a new place. That question of the future of Unitarian Universalism belongs in this space right now, belongs with us and what we do with this tradition we've inherited. But it really belongs to the future. It belongs to the new generation coming up, and whether our denomination remains relevant in that future. Blessed be.